the gain which BP received on the amounts wrongfully withheld from the royalty owners. For clarification, when I use the term moratorium interest today, I am referring to the prejudgment interest amount that is provided for in Colorado Revised Statute, Section 5-12-102-1A, which provides that when money is wrongfully withheld, interest shall be an amount which fully recognizes the gain or benefit to the person wrongfully withholding such money. Now, the district court in this case erred in granting BP's Rule 56H motion for four primary reasons. First, the district court's conclusion that the commingling of the wrongfully withheld amounts is fatal to the royalty owner's moratorium interest claim is in direct conflict with the applicable Colorado Supreme Court decisions. Second, the district court erred in imposing a specific proof requirement to the royalty owner's moratorium interest claim. Third, the district court erred in concluding that the royalty owner's evidence was not sufficient to demonstrate and prove BP's gain on the specific funds wrongfully withheld from the royalty owners. And fourth, the district court erred in concluding that the amount of moratorium interest sought from BP was manifestly punitive. Now, with respect, going back to the first reason, contrary to the district court's ruling, the Colorado Supreme Court, in the case of Colorado and Smelting Company versus Reed, has specifically held that a plaintiff may trace amounts that are being withheld from him into commingled funds and may recover not just the amount that is withheld from him, but also his share of the defendant's profit received on its investment of the commingled funds into its ongoing business operations.
Counsel, in this case, wasn't it conceded that your experts did not engage in that tracing exercise?
I'm sorry.
Am I correct in that there was no tracing done in this case by your experts or your client's experts?
There was tracing done in this case, Judge Fox. I mean, what we looked at, the amounts that were wrongfully withheld from the royalty owners, they were consistently commingled by BP into its master bank account funds, which held not only the wrongfully withheld funds from the royalty owners, but also revenues from BP's operations throughout the United States. So they all became part of one master bank account fund. BP then invested the amounts that were in its master bank account into its ongoing business operations, including its oil and gas operations in Colorado. So BP invested the combined fund, which is the wrongfully withheld funds from the royalty owners and its other revenues, into its ongoing oil and gas operations, including its operations in the state of Colorado. And the royalty owners expert utilized the BP financial reports, which reflected its rate of profit on the Colorado oil and gas operations in determining the moratorium interest damages. In other words, it used the annualized rate of profit that BP enjoyed on investing its master bank account funds into its ongoing Colorado oil and gas operations.
Counsel, there's a statement in the trial court's order on the 56 motion which expresses its concern. You know, it says that, you know, although plaintiff's experts has apparently done a thorough job of piecing together the performance of Amoco Colorado's assets during the relevant time period, plaintiff simply cannot make the required connection between the performance of these assets and the performance of the withheld funds. And I have that same concern. Where is that connection?
The connection is, Judge Fox, and this is exactly what they were talking about in the Reed case. If you look at the facts in the Reed case, and I'm going to give you that as a predicate to the answer to your question, the defendant in that case held the amounts that were due and owing to the plaintiff. And in that case, the defendant commingled those amounts with the funds that were in the defendant's general bank account. And then the defendant in the Reed case invested the general bank account funds, which included, you know, the commingled funds, into its ongoing business operations and earns an average annual rate of profit of 5%.
But in that case, all the funds are in this general account, and we know what all the funds were spent for, but here we don't. We have a master bank account that you say was used to fund operations worldwide, nationwide, I don't know. So we don't have any information, once the funds are commingled, as to what really the rate of profit was for the use of those funds outside of Colorado. Without that, we're left in the dark. I mean, what if they lost money in New York? What if they lost money offshore somewhere? Why isn't that calculated in?
Judge Jones, you're absolutely right. Here's the reason that was not considered. And this was covered in our opening brief in the section talking about our efforts in the trial court to obtain BP's rate of return, their profit results in other parts of the United States. We asked BP to produce, on a motion to compel, let me start out. We asked for the documents that reflected BP's rate of return in its oil and gas operations throughout the United States. And when BP objected to producing that, we filed a motion to compel with the trial court. And the trial court denied our request to obtain all of the, you know, return on capital cost results through the profit results for all of its operations throughout the United States.
And have you appealed that order?
We have not appealed that order, but we utilized what was the next best thing. We were given Colorado. We had the data for Colorado. And so we utilized that data as a representative sample of BP's gain on the amounts which it invested in the master bank account funds. What we had. Now, we have
How do we know it's representative? We have no way of knowing it's representative.
Well, let me put it this way. What we did was we submitted a representative sample. You know, from the Cloud case, the Cloud versus Williams case, we talked about this in a brief. It said that sampling is an appropriate method of proving moratory interest damages, but royalty on payment damages. And that's what we did here because we didn't have access to all of the information. So what we did was we used the data that we had. We had the biggest amount of data from Colorado. There was also some data from New Mexico, Wyoming, and Utah. We're not saying, Judge Jones, that there may not be other evidence of what the gain or benefit was on the master bank account funds. What we're saying is that once the amounts are commingled, the royalty owners' amounts, with the funds in the master bank account funds, that you can then trace the profit on the investment of those master bank account funds by looking to the rate of profits on the ongoing operations.
But ongoing operations, yes, but not ongoing operations in a particular locale, because that allows you to cherry pick the locale. You can take the most profitable locale, ignore all the others, and say, oh, look, they made 1,000% profit here, even though they might have lost money somewhere else. We don't want you to consider that. And I understand your point about the discovery, but we don't have an appeal issue about whether you were improperly denied discovery.
Well, we used the sampling that was given to us. I mean, we used the sampling that was given to us. BP did not put any evidence into the summary judgment record which suggested that the Colorado results were out of whack to what BP earned on its other, you know, operations, or that they were aberrationally high. They had the data. They had the information. If in the summary judgment record, they had come in and said, well, that rate of return, that rate of profit in our investment in the master bank account funds into the Colorado operations was abnormally high, they could have put the evidence in to prove that. And that's exactly what, you know, the case law in Colorado says. You can prove your loss through the best evidence obtainable under the circumstances. And that's what we put in.
But that evidence has to reach a certain threshold. It can't just be any evidence just because it's the best evidence. It has to make logical sense, doesn't it?
Well, it does make logical sense here because we had extensive data over a 25-year period of their rate of return. From 1992 all the way through 2011. And so we're not saying that there might not be other evidence that could be presented in a full-blown evidentiary hearing. We're saying that the evidence shows that they made a rate of return that was much higher than the 8% statutory rate that applies under 1B of the statute. And so we used the evidence that was given to us. We used the evidence that the court allowed us to have to prove it. And that was the only evidence in the record of BP's gain or benefit on its investment of the BP Master Bank account funds. So it was, I think it was sufficient under the circumstances. And certainly, if, you know, the issue here is, the legal issue is, does the commingling of the funds prevent the royalty owners from proving BP's gain or benefit? And the answer to the question of law is that it does not under the Reed case.
Well, I'm not sure that's the question. I mean, I think really the question is, assuming that you're right about that, did you present sufficient evidence tying the funds that were wrongfully withheld to the profits you contend that BP earned on those particular funds?
Well, we used the evidence that was available to us. We made the effort to get all of the, you know, the returns from throughout the United States. But the issue that the trial court ruled was, we can't show what happened to the specific funds that were withheld because they were put and made part of the commingled fund. And that's exactly what the Reed case said. The Colorado Supreme Court decision Reed said was wrong. And we were making every effort to get all the data we could. We used the Colorado data. But again, if the defendant believed that there was a higher rate of, or a lower rate of return in its other operations throughout the United States, it should have put that evidence into the record.
But didn't your clients have the burden of proof with respect to moratory interest?
Oh, we definitely had.
So it's not their burden to show that you're wrong. They can simply point out that your evidence is insufficient.
Well, they're pointing out that our evidence is insufficient based upon a contention that they made, that they took the position in the trial court that the rate of return information throughout the United States was not even relevant. So we are in and trying to get all of the rate of return information we could get, and we simply didn't get it. But we used the Colorado as demonstrating the specific gain or benefit, and certainly BP was free to put in whatever rate of other gain to demonstrate that the actual rate of gain was lower if you looked at the whole United States. But of course, they objected to producing that.
But why did they have to produce anything when they're saying the rate is the statutory rate, and you have to prove that something other than the statutory rate applies? So why are you shifting that burden to them?
I'm not shifting the burden to them. I'm saying that we brought into evidence the profit results for the Colorado operations, which is, you know, where this operation took place. We brought in the profit results for the Colorado operations from 1992 all the way through the year 2011. That information was given to us. So we used that information to determine the rate of profit. And these were from BP's financial reports. But again, I'm saying we gave a showing that that rate of profit was much, much higher. It averaged 22% versus 8% statutory rate. Average rate of return was 22% per year. So we made the showing. And we made the showing with the data that was available to us. We're not suggesting that if this case goes back for a full evidentiary hearing in the district court, that BP is precluded necessarily from producing whatever evidence they can to show that the percentage gain or rate is actually lower than the 22% rate that we showed. But what we are saying is, we've submitted a prima facie case in a summary judgment setting that demonstrates that we can prove that. And then it's up to them, if we have a full-blown trial, to demonstrate that it's something lower. But again, I mean, that's something that would be taken up on remand by the court. And I suggest we have made a prima facie showing. Very quickly, I know my time's short, and I do want to reserve some of my time for rebuttal. But both the Marriage of Allen and the Reed cases show that this concept that of commingling does not preclude a plaintiff from showing that the defendant, you know, earned a rate of profit on the commingled funds, and that the plaintiff has a right to share in what that benefit was, what that gain was on the commingled funds that the defendant invests in its ongoing business operations. The next point is, and that's followed up by the Marriage Mallon decision. I know that's talked about in our briefs. That was a 1986 decision in which the court essentially reaffirmed the principles in Reed and said that if the defendant is holding money that belongs to the plaintiff, in effect, the defendant is converted into a constructive trustee, and the plaintiff becomes a beneficiary of that constructive trust, who can recover not only what's been withheld from him, but also the profits traceable to the amounts that are being wrongfully withheld by the defendant.
But why do we have to resort to constructive trust theories or doctrines when we have a statute that's in play? And aren't we confined to the language in that statute?
We are. And what the statute says that interest shall be an amount which fully recognizes the gain or benefit to the person wrongfully withholding the money. And the court in the Great Western Sugar case says that in determining the permissible means of calculating the gain or benefit to the defendant wrongfully withholding the money, that you have to look to the statutory intent. And what the Court of Appeals said in that decision issued in 1989 is when you look to that statutory intent, you're looking to a statutory intent which says that the purpose of the moratorium interest statute is to ensure that is to discourage a wrongdoer who is wrongfully withholding money and delaying judgment or settlement in order to enjoy a rate of profit which is greater than the 8% statutory rate he will eventually have to pay. And the court further emphasized that under the moratorium interest statute, any benefit that the wrongdoer gains on wrongfully withheld money should be enjoyed not by the wrongdoer, but by the injured party. And that's probably the most on-point case of the Colorado Court of Appeals that's been issued with respect to the subject matter we're really talking about here, which is a permissible means of proving the defendant's gain or benefit.
Counsel, if you could please address the district court's rationale that the award of moratorium interest that your client sought would be punitive because it was, what did the court say, 17 and a half times greater than the statutory interest rate. I assume that's because of compounding.
It is because of compounding.
All right, so could you address that, that the statute is not intended to be punitive, and this is punitive because it's so much higher than the moratorium rate?
It's so much higher than the statutory rate, you mean?
Yes, excuse me, the statutory rate.
Absolutely. There are really two reasons why the amount is greater, and you touched also on the compounding, but that's a factor. But here are the two reasons. The reason that this is such a large dollar amount is because BP concealed the material facts from the royalty owners for the entire class time period and beyond that. So with the result that BP has wrongfully withheld the funds from the royalty owners in this case for a period of time which is greater than 27 years. And during that period of time, BP has continuously enjoyed a very high rate of profit on its investment of these wrongfully withheld funds into its ongoing business operations. And that's the reason that it's such a high dollar amount. One other point I'll make on that, just give you a quick example. If you have $1 million that's owed and you use the 8% rate and you have a 28-year period of time that you calculate that interest rate on, compound annually, at an 8% rate, the total interest rate that's owed, or the total amount of interest that's owed at the end of the 28-year period, say January 1st, 1986 through the end of December 2014, it's $8.3 million. If you double the interest rate to say 16% and you make that calculation, that same calculation, what amount of interest accrues over that period of time? And one might think, well, it's $16.6 million. It's not. It's $73 million. And if you use the 22% rate, it's $318 million. That's what explains why it's such a large dollar amount. That's not punitive. That's simply a fair and accurate reflection of the profit which the defendant earns on the monies that are wrongfully withheld from the plaintiff. I know I've not gotten to a lot of my argument, but I am going to reserve my remainder of time for rebuttal.
You may. You have just about 9 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Scott Barker, appearing today on behalf of Appalee and cross-appellant VP America Production Company. With me are my co-counsel, and they also tried the case with me, Reed Newrider, Kendra Beckwith, and Nate Murphy. I would like to start with VP's appellate issues and then address the moratory interest issue last, and I'll watch the clock and try to reserve some of my time for a little bit of rebuttal on VP's appellate issues. I want to start with the class certification issues because it is a question of first impression. The way this case was handled, the fraudulent concealment claim was handled prior to and going into the trial and filing to the jury. And in a nutshell, the way the trial court handled the certification and trial of the fraudulent concealment claim resulted in what I call a majority rules approach to class certification, which is improper as a matter of law because it deprived BP of its due process rights to assert and prosecute defenses that it had individual claims in the case. We believe that given the choice that class counsel made, which was to go ahead and try to get a jury verdict based upon the class as it was certified, resulted in a situation where, as the evidence showed at trial, the plaintiffs could not have convinced a reasonable juror that all of the class members had suffered the same harm with respect to the fraudulent concealment claim. So our first contention is that the trial court should have granted BP's motion for direct verdict on the fraudulent concealment claim. Failing that, in the alternative, given the variations that existed in the records, both in discovery and also during trial, rather than sending that claim to the jury, the trial court should have, at a minimum, decertified the class and sent that claim to the jury only on the named plaintiff's claims of fraudulent concealment. Now, there's a lot of law that's cited in briefs on both sides of this issue. I think the law that governs your deliberations and your decision with respect to the class certification issues comes down to three appellate decisions and one Colorado statute. Two of those appellate decisions are federal decisions, and one of them is Patterson 2, and finally there's the Rules Enabling Statute in Colorado. Now, as the court is very, very aware, Colorado appellate courts will look to federal precedent on the rules of procedure where the rules, as in this case, are identical. And I believe that the cases say that Colorado appellate courts will find such federal authority highly persuasive. And hopefully you will agree with me that both the Walmart versus Duke Supreme Court decision and the Carrera versus Bayer Corporation Third Circuit decision are highly persuasive for your deliberations with respect to this issue. And what do those two cases say? Well, first of all, if you start from the fundamental proposition that a class action is a procedural mechanism designed in the right circumstances to allow a number of claims to be handled at the same time. And Walmart versus Dukes, basing it on due process, makes the point that in order to have a valid class action, you have to have a situation where all the class members suffered the same injury so that all of the claims could be resolved with a stroke of a pen. That's not only the way Rule 23 works, that's the due process aspect of this thing, and that's where we come to Carrera versus Bayer Corporation. That was actually an ascertainability case, but in the process of ruling on that case, the Third Circuit made it clear and said, and this won't be an exact quote, but it'll be a paraphrase, and the two words that stuck in my mind from that quote is that you cannot certify and try a class action in such a way that it either eviscerates the defendant's right to assert individual defenses or it masks those individual defenses in the class certification context. So that's the structure within which we're operating here. Now let's talk about Patterson II, because as I'm sure the court knows, Patterson II was part of a trilogy. It was handed down by the Colorado Supreme Court in October of 2011. Uncal versus Jackson, benzene case, and also Patterson versus BP. Ironically, those three cases were issued on Halloween. It wasn't a particularly good Halloween for me, given the result in that case. But what one of the things that Patterson said in the process of affirming the trial court's certification of the class was that that certification was subject to the defendant's right to bring forward individual evidence to demonstrate that class certification was inappropriate, and that that right started from the day the decision was issued and it went all the way through trial.
And isn't that what the district court did? I mean, it allowed for quite a bit of evidence considering individual circumstances of, you know, certain types of class members and individual class members as well.
Well, actually, Judge Fox, I beg to differ, because when the case was remanded back down to the district court for discovery on the merits, BP requested the opportunity to issue a written survey to all class members on fraudulent concealment issues. That was denied. That would have been a way to get to what on its surface appeared to be a lot of variations in the class makeup. And that request was denied.
Again, isn't that a discovery dispute, and is that in front of us?
No, that's not in front of you, and I'll come back to that. But the answer to your question is ultimately, we only were given an opportunity to take 9 depositions out of 4,000. So, but you're right. This is not a discovery dispute. This is something else, and I'll come back to that. Did I answer your question?
Yes, you did.
So the case goes to trial. The plaintiff's class counsel rolled the class action dice, betting that they could prove that all members of the class had suffered from the same harm on the fraudulent concealment claim. Now, this is where we come to the evidence that we were able to marshal, but with respect to people who did not have claims. And in that regard, I think it's important to recall this court's decision in the Patterson 1, which was the statute of limitations issue, as it made its way up to the Supreme Court in that case. This court had reason to consider the role that the division and transfer orders played in this whole picture of fraudulent concealment. And this court said that two things. Number one, that those division orders did not demonstrate actual knowledge, but they did create a fact issue with respect to whether or not the people who read these documents should have known the way BP was calculating its royalties. So at trial, of course, the division orders became a very important part of the proof. And every class member, undisputed, signed a division order or a transfer order. Now we come to the oil and gas companies, and I want to talk about two of the oil and gas companies that testified at trial. Abraxas, which actually admitted that they weren't defrauded, and PEC, who testified that they were aware of the netback and in fact had used the netback process to calculate its royalties, just like BP did. And of course, as the court knows from the briefs, the netback is the process of deducting cost to arrive at a wellhead value. Trial Exhibit 280, which is the class list of all 4,000 class members, and it was referred to by class counsel within 2 minutes of standing up and closing argument, that document demonstrates there are approximately 40 oil and gas companies in the class. Undisputed at trial that oil and gas companies were aware of deregulation. Undisputed at trial that oil and gas companies were aware of the netback, and as I said, PEC, actually Mr. Julander testified by deposition, they actually used the netback. Now, that is an undisputed platform for constructive knowledge, because the law says that if the defendant or the plaintiff is on notice such that they should be making an inquiry beyond what they know, then that isn't good enough for fraudulent concealment, and that's exactly what happened with respect to the basket of oil and gas companies. Now, let me also talk a little bit more about Trial Exhibit 280, because as Judge Fox has already pointed out, that it wasn't a discovery issue, but certainly class counsel, in his closing argument, basically asked the jury to decide the fraudulent concealment claim on a majority rules basis. He had the class list, and he said there are about some less than 40 are oil and gas companies, some churches. The rest of them are individuals like you and me. A clear invitation to ignore the 40 companies or so who clearly could not get to the jury on fraudulent concealment.
One first question, was there an objection to that?
We object. Actually, there wasn't in the closing argument, Your Honor, but we had tendered a different jury instruction on what the plaintiffs had to prove in order to prove on behalf of the entire class. That jury instruction was rejected by the trial court, and I think that's where we preserved our objection to that argument.
All right, but to the extent you're arguing now that there was some error or some, created by closing argument,
no.
How can you argue that on appeal? You haven't preserved that.
Actually, I'm not arguing. If I said that, I misspoke, Your Honor. The point I'm trying to make is that everybody in the courtroom knew that the oil and gas companies didn't have a fraudulent concealment claim, including class counsel who tried to carve it out. I'm not saying it was error for him to argue that. I'm simply saying it supports my point that, in fact, there were class members who went to the jury who could not have satisfied the proof of fraudulent concealment, and that's error because it deprives BP of its due process rights.
All right, so you've got 1% of the 4,000, and you, under your view of the law, that's enough to just decertify as to the other 3,960 members.
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, that is exactly it, because it's a due process issue. And you, let me put it this way. You can't allow convenience to trump due process rights. That's not the way our law works. And I forgot, by the way, to mention a very important part of the law, the mix of the law here, and it goes, I think, directly to your question, Judge Jones, and that is the Colorado Rules Enabling Act, which is found at CRS 13-2-108, which actually authorizes the Supreme Court to issue rules of civil procedure, but it also says that those rules cannot abridge, enlarge, or modify substantive rights. So, and I think that Colorado statute is consistent with Walmart versus Dukes and Carrera. And now back to your point, Judge Jones. The point is that, as harsh as that sounds, that's the way the due process right works. So that's the answer to your question. Now, but beyond that,
well, if that kind of objection were made, couldn't the court just do a partial decertification?
Well, actually, you know, the court could have, but did not.
Did you ask it to?
No, we had asked the court to decertify the case prior to trial. But let me also point out that there's another way to deal with that issue, and that is that class counsel could have asked the court to carve those people out at some point in the process, and they never did. So I don't think the defendant should be hamstrung because of a decision that was made by plaintiff's counsel.
But you have an existing certification order. So it's your burden to go forward to show that there's something wrong with that, to decertify. It's your motion, your burden. So isn't it your burden to ask for a carve-out?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I respectfully disagree with that. And we did, by the way, of course, move to decertify, and we are also urging that as an error before you as well. So in the alternative, we would request that you would remand the case back with instructions to decertify the fraudulent concealment claim, because it was improperly, it was an error not to decertify. And if I could, let me talk a little bit about that, because I think there's a legal error in the court's consideration of the motion to decertify. And that legal error is that the court improperly based the decertification denial on the assumption that the only issue, if you will, with respect to reliance or knowledge, was whether or not the plaintiffs had actual knowledge of the royalty methodology, and completely, of course, overlooking the should have known aspect of it. And even though there was tremendous variation as the court's order denying the motion for decertification indicated. So, like I say, I think so. In other words, I just to kind of wrap this, unless the court has more questions with respect to the class certification issues, I would say this, that it is harsh, but due process is due process, and class counsel took the risk of being able to prove that all of the class members had suffered the same injury as required by Walmart versus Dukes and Carrera. They failed, therefore a Rule 50 motion should have been granted. And then other than that, and by the way, Judge Jones, one other thing, the court has the ultimate authority under Rule 23 to make a decision to decertify or treat the class. It doesn't require a motion on the part of the party. So we would respectfully request that you reverse the trial court's denial of the motion for directed verdict, or failing that, we request that you would remand with instructions to decertify the class. Let me now move in to, unless there are more questions on that aspect of the case, let me move on to the jury instruction question. And I'm going to do this one in real summary form, because I think the briefs pretty well cover this. But I think this issue, of course, we requested the instruction that the jury be told that a party who signs a contract, in this case the division order or transfer order, is charged with knowledge of what's in that document. And that was a very important instruction, because the testimony at trial essentially was, well, my lawyer looked at it, I didn't, or I didn't look at it, didn't really study it, it was boilerplate, didn't really mean anything to me. And that became a very important part of our argument, or we wanted to make it a very important part of our argument, on why the evidence showed that these people read the documents, the netback was described in them, and the law says that they're charged with knowledge of what's there. I think that this is a straightforward application of this court's decision in Schuster versus Werler. Very similar, Schuster versus Werler. It's the facts are virtually identical. The situation where the defendant requested an instruction at trial, trial court said no. You can argue the facts to the jury. Went up to this court. The court said no. That's not right. If you're entitled to an instruction, leading into argument is not good enough. That's exactly what the trial court did here. At the jury instruction conference, the court said, it may be in the cases, you can argue to the jury. I believe that reversal under Schuster versus Werler is appropriate. Now, that brings me to the marketability question, which of course was the chief liability issue at trial. And as everybody knows, the marketability decision is governed by the Supreme Court's decision in Rogers versus Westerman. There's no question about that. But I think if I'm sitting in your position, I'm probably saying, well, really, this is just a common battle of the experts. BP called in experts, the plaintiffs called in experts. They testified, and the jury kind of sorted it out, and they ruled against you, Mr. Barker. Just kind of take your lumps and move on. But that's not what happened here. This is a situation where the plaintiff's proof failed to meet the requirements of the law as set forth in Rogers versus Westerman. Rogers versus Westerman says very clearly, and in that decision, of course, it's a rather lengthy decision, and after it kind of decided the issues before it, it went on to talk, well, actually, I guess this is part of the issue. The jury instructions that had been given by the court below were reviewed by the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said they were not proper, and the reason they were not proper was because they focused the fact finder's attention only on the conduct of the defendant. And the Supreme Court of Colorado in Rogers versus Westerman ruled that in order to have a proper analysis of the marketability issue, you have to have evidence, or you have to look at more than just the conduct of the defendant. And that's exactly what happened at trial here. The plaintiffs called two experts on the marketability issue, Ms. Bourquet and Mr. Reinecke. Neither one of them looked at any conduct other than BP's. That I respectfully submit, doesn't get you to a jury under Rogers versus Westerman. And then beyond that, and I hesitate to do this, but I think under the circumstances it makes sense, because there was uncontested testimony and evidence in the record that, based upon the conduct of market participants other than BP, that there was indeed a market for the purchase and sale of natural gas at the wellhead in the DJ Basin, which of course was BP's contention. And I'm just going to rip through that pretty quick. It's in the briefs. First of all, the first witness who testified in the case was Henry Tarver, a former BP employee, who testified that he was aware that during the class period, numerous what he called moms and pops, which are small oil and gas production companies or gas production companies, were selling gas at the well. Two class members of the class that we called in, testified that they were selling gas at the well. A gentleman by the name of David Posner, who was employed by Snyder Oil, was a gas marketer out there in the DJ Basin, testified about numerous companies who were buying and selling gas at the well during the class period. And then finally, there was billions of cubic feet of gas that was actually sold by BP at the well during the class period that were not really criticized by plaintiffs' experts. In fact, in calculating the damages in the case, plaintiff's damages expert carved out the gas that was sold by BP at the well. So not only do you have a failure of proof under Rogers versus Westerman, given the undisputed facts in the record, that should not have gone to the jury. We should have gotten a directed verdict. That brings me to the moratory interest issue. And Judge Fox has already indicated that the trial court's ruling sets forth the undisputed facts that upon which its decision was based. I believe, if my memory serves me correctly, that order is found beginning at page 5353 of the record. I commend it to your reading, because the trial court did a comprehensive job of setting forth the undisputed facts upon which he based his decision. Now, let me talk a little bit about the law that governs, because although the trial court relied primarily on the Atlantic Richfield case, ARCO, we found it to be strongly analogous because, in fact, it also arose in a royalty context and the facts were similar. But the trial court also cited the Supreme Court's decision, the Colorado Supreme Court's decision in Ballo versus FICO. And I submit to you that Ballo versus FICO is really almost governs here, if you will. And certainly the Atlantic Richfield case is consistent with the holding in Ballo. And let me just spend a minute or two talking about the Ballo case. That was a situation where the moratory interest had been based upon a 9.4% Treasury note rate, and there was no evidence at trial in the record that the defendant had ever taken advantage of that 9.4% interest rate. I submit to this court that that is very similar to the situation we have here. If you look at the undisputed facts in the record, there is no evidence of what gain or benefit that BP derived from the money that was withheld from the royalties. That proof did not exist. And that really was the fundamental undisputed fact upon which the trial judge based his decision.
So, counsel, your position is that the commingling ended it. Once the money was commingled, there could be no tracing.
On this record, that's correct.
Well, under what record could there be tracing if the money was kept?
Well, if for instance, well, you could hypothesize a situation where the money was kept in a separate account and there were separate investments. I mean, there are different scenarios that might happen. But on this record, there's simply no indicate. There's no going. It would be it's sheer speculation to try to figure out how much gain or benefit BP derived from the money that was withheld with respect to the royalties.
Well, let's take an example. I think your opponent's relying on the Reed case, where the money goes into a general account. And that general account is used for a business. And as a result of the use of whatever money is in the general account, there is a particular rate of return. All right, it seems to me that if the money is used to, all the money in that account is used to achieve a particular rate of return, then it follows logically that the money that was wrongfully withheld was used to achieve that rate of return.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I think it's important to remember that that case, the Reed case, is a constructive trust case. It's not a decision under the statute.
I understand that, but still, I mean, we're talking about tracing. I mean, as a logical matter, again, if all the money is used to get X rate of return and that money includes the wrongfully withheld money, why hasn't it been traced? It seems to me it has been, just as a logical matter. It's a subset of the money that's used.
Well, I respectfully submit, Your Honor, that's not tracing. The facts in this case were that there was never, that the wells in question never operated as a financially, they never operated as a standalone proposition. All of the business units that those wells were in from time to time included revenues from other areas aside from the one in question. And in fact, and if you go and if you look, if you want to dive into the record and go into the undisputed facts that are summarized in the trial court's decision, you'll see, this is right around the 4700 series of the record, you will see that the document upon which plaintiff's experts relied most heavily was a document that included in it, it's called the Southern Rockies Business Unit, which included BP's coal bed methane properties in the San Juan Basin, which are largely in New Mexico, that pooches up into southwestern Colorado, totally different kind of gas, totally different dynamic. That's where the commingling occurred. So back to your question, Judge Jones, I think this is a far cry from a business that has a bank account for all of its unified operations to say that their rate of return might be the same on that pool of money versus a pool of money that is diverse, different kind of gas, completely. So
here the pool of money, this general bank account, is used to finance operations in many places, presumably. That's your argument.
Right.
Okay. And because it's doing that, were one to even buy the constructive trust argument, one would still have to determine what was the rate of return as to that bank account.
That's right.
Okay.
Unless there are many further questions, I think I got 3 minutes and 12 seconds left. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
I want to quickly cover the points that BP raised. First of all, with respect to the motion to decertify, what the district court did is it thoroughly evaluated the evidence that BP presented in its motion to decertify. There were approximately 9 deposed orders, deposed royalty owners, which BP had hand-selected. I mean, they selected these members of the oil and gas industry to depose. But what the trial court properly found was none of those class members knew that BP was deducting these marketing costs in the calculation of royalties. They all testified to that. None of them knew that, and remember, when they talk about these division orders, this court in the 2006 decision had previously determined that the division order itself did not provide actual notice to the royalty owners of the method of calculating royalties because there were two alternative methods of calculating royalties that were set forth in that division order, one of which was based on regulated prices where they would take no deductions and the other deregulated prices where they would take deductions to calculate the royalties. And what this court held was that division order would only provide actual notice if BP subsequently notified the royalty owners of its intent, of the fact that gas sales were deregulated and intended to begin taking the deductions. The evidence was uncontested that none of the royalty owners were ever informed by BP that their royalties were being paid based on deregulated prices. And there was no testimony from any royalty owner that they had that knowledge from any other source either. And that's what the district court relied upon in saying that BP had not shown that any of these royalty owners had actual knowledge of the deductions. They also want to point to this testimony from the Abraxas representative. The Abraxas representative testified, just like all the other royalty owners, didn't know about the deductions, didn't know about the price deregulation. Their testimony was consistent with the testimony of all the other royalty owners. All these royalty owners, after they signed the division order, they got no notice of the price deregulation, but I'll tell you what they did get. They got royalty statements from BP, which consistently informed them that falsely informed them that their royalties were being paid based on the total value of the gas which BP sold, less deductions only for taxes. So none of these royalty owners they all understood from that, from looking at these royalty statements, that they were being paid on the price that BP sold the gas for, less deductions only for taxes. And that's the evidence that the district judge carefully reviewed and evaluated in denying BP's motion to decertify, and set forth very thoroughly in that. And it's the same thing with respect to the testimony at trial. The testimony at trial was the same thing. None of the royalty owners knew about the deductions. None knew about deregulation. BP acknowledged that they had no evidence they ever told anybody about deregulation. BP never produced any evidence that ever informed any of the 4,000 class members that the marketing cost deductions were told by them.
As to those class members that were part of the industry and that were either utilizing the same methodology or that were aware of the deregulation, would they have had a reason to inquire?
The testimony was with respect to Juhlander or Petroleum Energy Corporation that they disclosed their deductions. So when they got the statements from BP that falsely stated that they were, you know, getting the royalties based on the actual price less deductions on for taxes, they assumed that's what it was. On Abraxas, they were a Texas-based oil and gas producer, didn't know anything, and got about $12 a year in royalties, and didn't know anything about how Colorado royalties were calculated. By the way, Abraxas, the witness said that he was not aware that he'd been defrauded by BP, but he was not aware of the fact that BP's own employees had recommended that BP change its method of calculating the royalties in a unanimous recommendation to management, and then management rejected it because they were concerned about royalty underpayment claims and the threat that the litigation would completely eliminate their right to take any of these cost deductions, which they were consistently concealing. So the evidence was undisputed and really never contested that all the elements on the fraudulent concealment tolling claim were satisfied. Secondly, this jury instruction that they're talking about, that they proposed about, you know, a person should be bound by the documents or by the contracts they sign. Several things about that. First of all, as the Supreme Court said, they're really trying to emphasize specific evidence related to the claim, that the elements of the fraudulent concealment were set forth. But importantly, the royalty owners never argued that they weren't on notice of whatever the language in the division orders. What we argued consistently was, and consistent with the decision in the 2006 of this court, we argued that those division orders didn't give us actual knowledge of anything, didn't give us actual knowledge of BP's method of calculating the royalties, because it didn't tell whether or not the prices were deregulated or not, or whether the gas was sold on or off the property. So it wasn't a significant issue in the case, and if you look at the testimony of the royalties anyway, of the royalty owners anyway, there was only one royalty owner out of nine testifying royalty owners who said clearly that he did not review the division order, and that was Mr. Sarchet. All of the others, there was testimony from three of them that they did review the division orders. There was testimony from Mr. Juhlander that he doesn't even know if he got a division order that contained that gas covenant. Same thing with the Abraxas Petroleum. Sandra Reed was never asked whether she reviewed the division order. So for BP to ask for this type of jury instruction would have been highly improper, particularly since it was not a significant issue in the case, and we weren't arguing the concept that we weren't on notice of the language in the division order itself. Finally, with respect to the submissibility of the Rogers case. If you look at the Rogers decision, it repeatedly emphasized that the question of marketability is a question of fact to be decided by the jury. This court in the Savage and the Cloud cases stated the same thing and rejected the argument that there was insufficient evidence, and in particularly held that merely because the gas is sold is not a showing that there's a market at the place where the gas is sold. And we talked about that in our brief. And there was substantial testimony presented that backed up the testimony of our experts through the testimony of former BP employees about where the location of the market was for both the natural gas liquids and the residue gas. I know my time is short. I'm going back to the moratory interest. And one thing that I want to point out here is that the issue in the Rule 56H question of law that was submitted by BP, that BP filed the Rule 56H motion, and the issue was that the argument they made was that the commingling of the funds, of the wrongfully withheld funds into the master bank account, precluded the royalty owners from proving the amount of BP's gain or benefit as a matter of law. And we submitted evidence and said, no, that's not right. There is a tracing here, and we do have evidence of what the gain or benefit was to BP. The issue was not on the Rule 56H motion what exact amount of royalty interest or, you know, moratory interest should the royalty owners recover. This was not a full-blown trial on the merits. It was a Rule 56H motion that was predicated on the argument that a commingling of the funds precluded, as a matter of law, the royalty owner's ability to prove the gain or benefit. And we met that question of law by establishing that you can prove that. And I would respectfully submit that we did the best with the evidence that we had. And that's sufficient. And to suggest that because we didn't produce all the evidence, which had been denied to us anyway, to prove the exact amount is not what was at issue in the Rule 56H motion.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I think you have just over 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think it's important to remember that on the fraudulent concealment claim at trial, our theory was not only actual knowledge, but more importantly, on the facts of the case as it turned out, constructive knowledge, should have known. And although it may be true that some of the plaintiffs claim that they did not know how BP was calculating its royalties, that doesn't come to grips with whether or not they should have known. And that pulls us back, and I'm not going to go through it in detail again, but I'm just going to point out that here again, the evidence at trial was undisputed that it was widely known in the industry about deregulation. In fact, I believe Mr. Julander testified that he was aware of it. I believe the Abraxas people testified that they were aware of it as well. So you put all that basket together, and what you've got is it's that they had all the pieces of the puzzle. They were doing it themselves. They should have known. They should have picked up the phone and called and asked, and they never did that. And I think this goes back to the second of the two E words in the Carrera versus Bayer Corporation, the eviscerate, or I guess the other word is a mask. You cannot allow a class certification procedure to mask the defendant's individual defenses. And that's exactly what happened here with respect to the fraudulent concealment claim. And I think actually the discussion that Mr. Barton had with you about Abraxas is a very good example of that. There's a detailed analysis of what Abraxas did or didn't do, and we were deprived the opportunity to make those individual arguments on our side of that question to the jury because it was being submitted as a class action with a jury instruction that basically allowed the jury to eliminate the ones that didn't think applied and rule in favor of the others as a group. In other words, it's a majority rules approach to class certification, and that's just flat out improper. On the jury instruction, I come back to, yes, should have known was a very important part of our case. This wasn't just something that was sitting over in the corner. This was something that was right at the core of our defense, and that is despite the fact that all of our common knowledge is out there in the world where we get contracts. We quite often sign them without reading them. We go to the doctor's office and sign disclosures without reading them. We get statements from our utility provider. We don't read those. And it was a real danger that when the jury deliberated on this question of should have known, they imported their common background knowledge and said, well, you know, it's not such a big deal that they didn't read these documents. We were deprived of instruction that said, it makes no difference whether you think it's a big deal, because if you sign a document, you are charged with knowledge of what's in it. And that, and under the Schussler case, it's a might, whether the prejudices might have resulted in different, we would have had a better shot at getting the jury ruling in our favor. I think it might have made a difference. Thank you very much.
Thank you to both counsel, to all counsel, for your fine arguments today. And this case is now deemed submitted. You may expect a written opinion in due course. And the